And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. And on this great patriotic holiday, we confront a great question. Is American history a series of coincidences, of random occurrences, or is there a hidden hand behind our history, a greater hand arranging events? On this special broadcast of the Michael Medved Show, we take a look at God's hand on America. And even if you're a skeptic about questions like divine intervention or organization of human affairs, stick with me, and I want to tell you about a series of stories, a series of dramatic events covering some 300 years of American history that should persuade even the most hard-hearted skeptic that there is something spooky going on about the way that America came into being, flourished, and has survived all of these years. God's hand on America. And if you want to take a look at spooky coincidences, there is no place better to begin than the first big anniversary of American independence, our 50th anniversary on July 4th, 1826. This was a very, very big time for the young republic because, as you know, when the founding fathers launched our independence, it was doubtful that they could even win the independence struggle against Great Britain, let alone persevere with this new form of government for 50 years. And in 1826, there was tremendous satisfaction and pride about what America had endured and what America had achieved, about the growth of the country and the prosperity of the country. And people were very proud of the fact that the president of the United States at that time was John Quincy Adams, the son of one of the founders of America, one of the two people who had done more than any other two people to assure American independence with the draft and the successful adoption of the Declaration of Independence. John Adams had led the fight for independence in the Continental Congress, and his great colleague, friend and rival, Thomas Jefferson, had, of course, drafted the Declaration of Independence. People in the young republic were absolutely amazed that these two great Americans, the second president and the third president of the United States, respectively, were both alive to celebrate the glorious Fourth. Parades were planned all over the country, many of them dedicated to President Adams and President Jefferson, who were just hanging on to live to see that day. Adams was 90 years old. Jefferson was 83. And yet they were both in fine form, maybe physically weak. Jefferson in particular was suffering from diarrhea, which gave him a great deal of pain. But they had all their wits about them. And one demonstration of that is seen in the last letter that Jefferson ever wrote. He wrote it on June 24th, a little bit more than a week before the 4th of July, and it was a letter formally expressing his regret at not being able to come to Washington, D.C. from his home in Monticello, his mountaintop home, coming to Washington for the celebration. And he wrote his regrets, explained about his illness, but then talked about the significance of the Declaration of Independence, which was going to be celebrated. Jefferson wrote, "All eyes are opened or opening to the rights of man. The general spread of the light of science has already laid open to every view the palpable truth that the mass of mankind has not been born with saddles on their backs, nor a favored few booted and spurred, ready to ride them legitimately by the grace of God. These are grounds of hope for others. For ourselves, let the annual return of this day forever refresh our recollection of these rights and an undiminished devotion to them." His letter was considered so eloquent when it arrived in Washington that it was actually read publicly and dramatically on the 4th of July in his absence. Adams, 90 years old, home in Quincy, Massachusetts, sent his own regrets, signing the letter himself, writing it out himself, and his son, President John Quincy Adams, was assured to see that his father seemed to be well and in good spirits. And indeed, the two great elderly statesmen had been able to enjoy absolutely amazing retirements after they each left the White House. They had been bitter rivals, but they had become, again, after they both left the presidency, close friends, conducting a truly intense correspondence with one another. And one of the things that they expressed in that correspondence was their one hope that even with the infirmities of age, that they would have no infirmities of mind till the end. And that was indeed the case, because though they had increasing physical disabilities, Adams in particular, he was 8 years older than Jefferson, he was 90. Adams in particular had these physical infirmities, but he was sharp as a tack till the very end. 2 days before the anniversary day, the great glorious 50th anniversary of the New Republic and of the Declaration of Independence, Jefferson felt seriously ill. And he couldn't get up. They gave him some laudanum, which is a drug that was prescribed for everything in those days. But it made him a bit groggy. And for a while, he was ranting on deliriously about the Committee of Safety, which was one of the factors back in Virginia at the time of the Revolution. And he urged his brother patriots to be on the alert. But then his mind became more clear toward the very end, fading in and out of consciousness. People gathered around the bedside of the great man. It seemed to be his end. And they waited. They counted down the minutes till midnight on the 3rd of July, hoping that he could last till the 4th of July. Actually, he lasted till mid-afternoon, around 1 o'clock on the 4th of July. And then Thomas Jefferson, who had written the Declaration, awoke for a while and asked, "Is it the 4th?" Amazing. He lasted, he lived, and then passed into eternity on that great day. Because of communication and transportation at the time, neither Jefferson nor the people around him had any idea of the level of coincidence that was occurring and unfolding. Because at the same time that Jefferson reached his end, the same thing happened to John Adams. Adams, in the weeks before the 4th of July, continued his normal routine. On the 7th of June, he answered and regretfully declined because of his health an invitation from a local committee in Boston to attend the approaching celebration. He also turned down a celebration in his native town of Braintree, Quincy, Massachusetts. The anniversary, though, he wrote in his own unsteady hand, would mark, quote, a memorable epoch in the annals of the human race. An epoch, he said, destined in future history to form the brightest or the blackest page according to the use or the abuse of those political institutions by which they shall, in time to come, be shaped by the human mind. Some days later, a local committee called on the former president and requested that he communicate a sentiment for a toast that could be presented on his behalf at the local celebration. "I will give you," said he, "independence forever." When asked if he wished to add something further, he firmly replied, "Not a word." On the last day of June, President Adams received neighborly callers, and the next day he insisted on repaying their call, even though he had to be lifted into his carriage. He could barely walk. The exertion was too great. He fell ill on July 2nd. But on the 4th, he recognized it was the 4th, he refused to stay in bed. He insisted that his servants pick him up and take him to his usual chair in the upstairs study. He commented on the anniversary, and sometime afternoon, he said with great difficulty, "Thomas Jefferson survives." According to some accounts, he actually said, "Liberty is safe. Jefferson survives." Of course, Jefferson had died almost simultaneously. When word came to President John Quincy Adams that Thomas Jefferson, in Virginia, had died on the 4th of July, the 50th anniversary of the Republic, President Adams commented how strange and very striking indeed the coincidence was. He didn't even know that his own father had died on the same day. In fact, he had gotten word he was on his way to try to see his father for one last time. He'd gotten as far as Baltimore when word came by that the great patriot, his father, the second president, had died on the same day. What are the odds against this? The odds that one of the creators of American independence, either Jefferson or Adams, actually dies on the 4th of July, the 50th 4th of July, but both of them dying on that same day? No one who lived through it could mistake the hand of Providence on those events, nor should we, or on events even earlier in American history, in shaping the fate of this republic, God's hand on America. You're listening to one of the greatest hits from the year 1800. It's called Jefferson and Liberty. It was actually the campaign song that Thomas Jefferson used in his campaign for president, actually second campaign for president, against his old friend and rival John Adams. And Jefferson and Adams dying on the same day. Okay, you want to say it's just a weird coincidence. First of all, what are the odds? Not just the two former presidents and old rivals and old friends who together framed the Declaration of Independence. What are the odds that they should die on the same day? What are the odds that they should die even on the same year? And then that that day should be the 50th anniversary of their creation? No wonder that people who were alive at the time in 1826 had no problem at all recognizing the hand of God. The Attorney General of the United States at that time was William Wirt, and he said he saw the print of heaven itself in the concurrent deaths. God, he said, had hallowed the day anew by a double apotheosis. People shouldn't have been so surprised that there was something almost supernatural about some of the insights, some of the prophecy from these two men. Consider, for instance, a 50-year-old letter that John Adams had written to his wife Abigail right after the original events of 1776 concerning the anniversary day that would be, he felt, forever celebrated. He said that anniversary in July will be the most memorable epoca in the history of America. I am apt to believe that it will be celebrated by succeeding generations as the great anniversary festival. It ought to be commemorated as the day of deliverance by solemn acts of devotion to God Almighty. It ought to be solemnized with pomp and parade, with shows, games, sports, guns, bells, bonfires, and illuminations, meaning fireworks, from one end of this continent to the other from this time forward forevermore. You will think me transported with enthusiasm, he wrote to his wife, but I am not. I am well aware of the toil and blood and treasure that it will cost us to maintain this declaration and support and defend these states. Yet through all the gloom, I can see the rays of ravishing light and glory. Is it so surprising that someone with that kind of vision of his future, of the nation's future, should be called to his reward and to his eternal rest on precisely the day he might himself have chosen? It's also not surprising, when you look back, to see that some of the predecessors to John Adams in the state of Massachusetts had their own involvement with truly bizarre combinations of events and developments. I'm talking, of course, about the Pilgrims, the first permanent settlers in Massachusetts. Before the Puritan ancestors of John Adams, the Pilgrims, of course, landed on Plymouth Rock, Plymouth, Massachusetts, in 1620, at a time when they actually thought they were aiming for Virginia. And then later, they aimed for Manhattan. They didn't make it very far. They ended up back at that howling wilderness, a desolate wilderness, that terrified them all. And especially in the wintertime, New England, Massachusetts, can be pretty terrifying. But one of the truly amazing things about where they decided to locate is that clearly people had lived there before. They found a town site. And in fact, where they settled in Plymouth had a whole group of buried containers of corn that they used to prevent them from starvation. It turns out that historically there had been a village there, a Patuxet village, a village of a tribe of Indians who had lived in that area before, but just 2 years before the arrival of the Pilgrims, had been wiped out by some kind of mysterious plague. And here is where it gets very strange indeed. From that part of Massachusetts, from that particular tribe, there was only one survivor. His name was Tisquantum, also known as Squanto. And if you know the story of the first Thanksgiving, then you know that the Pilgrims ended up landing at precisely the point in Massachusetts that Squanto, had grown up. He was living there alone. His story was so amazing, so bizarre. He had been taken as a boy, been captured by some of the Europeans who traded with the Indians, were fishing along the coast. They captured a bunch of teenage Indians. He was sold in Malaga, Spain, as a slave. But he happened to be purchased by a group of monks. And the monks made him a Christian, taught him Western ways, and then eventually sent him to England, where he lived for several more years with a kindly family that taught him fluent English, all the while dreaming of coming back to his home in Massachusetts. Finally able to make the voyage, this young, now Christianized, now Europeanized, English-speaking Indian comes back to Massachusetts and finds, when he arrives, that his village has been wiped out. Everyone's died from a plague. But rather than living with another tribe, he lives in that area by himself with his memories until he is brought into contact with these new settlers. Now think about this for a moment. It's a very, very big continent, North America. There aren't a lot of Indians who've spent time in England. Really, there aren't. I mean, the combination of circumstances, to have an Indian kidnapped, dragged to Spain, sent to England, then sent back across the ocean to be thoroughly conversant in the English language and very sympathetic to these new English settlers, all of that was so striking as an act of providence that the Pilgrim leaders absolutely never mistook it. And Squanto, during the years that he spent with the Pilgrims, helped to rescue the colony, taught them where to fish, taught them how to plant corn, taught them how to survive, helped to translate and negotiate with other Indians, so that, unlike other settlements in other parts of North America, they never had a particular Indian problem. The Pilgrims recognized, without any question, that Squanto had been sent providentially by God to help them in their errand into the wilderness, their mission to try to build a model community, religious community, in Massachusetts. His existence, his life, that bizarre combination of circumstances, was dramatic, but certainly no more dramatic than the amazing circumstances attending another American who was born some 112 years later. He was a young man who seemed to be, in a truly bizarre and difficult to believe way, absolutely bulletproof. The fellow who couldn't be killed or even wounded. His name was George Washington. Tell you about it. Coming right back, God's Hand on America. marching song of a Continental Army in the American Revolution, Chester, by William Billings, reminding us of our greatest revolutionary hero, George Washington, who became a hero long before the American Revolution. He became a famous hero to all of the colonists when he was only 23 years old in July of 1755, when George Washington participated in the first major battle of the French and Indian War, the Battle of Monongahela near present-day Pittsburgh. It was the biggest disaster in the whole history of the British Army. A huge army led by General Braddock, of which Washington was a part, he was a 23-year-old colonel of the Virginia militia, was basically ambushed by the French and the Indians, and everyone was butchered. There were some 60 officers who on horseback made terrific targets. All 60 were either killed or wounded, except for one. His name was Washington. After the battle, George Washington wrote to his brother, John Augustine Washington, "As I have heard since my arrival at this place, Fort Cumberland, a circumstantial account of my own death and dying speech, I take this early opportunity of contradicting the first and of assuring you that I have not as yet composed the latter. But by the all-powerful dispensations of Providence, I have been protected beyond all human probability or expectation. For I had 4 bullets through my coat, and 2 horses shot under me, yet escaped unhurt, although death was leveling my companions on every side of me." Washington understood the special protection that he seemed to be under. So did the Reverend Samuel Davies. Just a few weeks after the battle, he later became president of Princeton University. He delivered a sermon in which he praised the military qualities of the Virginia provincials who had participated, and then said this. It was recorded at the time. "I may point out to the public that heroic youth, Colonel Washington, whom I cannot but hope Providence has hitherto preserved in so signal a manner for some important service to his country." Spooky! George Washington, unharmed, not only in this battle, but in every battle of the American Revolution, where on many cases, at Harlem Heights, at the Battle of Monmouth, even at the Battle of Yorktown, this huge guy, he was 6'3", some people say 6'4", at a time when the average height was 5'5 or 5'6". This huge guy was a great target. The British never hit him. Something very peculiar was going on, and people emphatically recognized it at the time. There is a truly amazing story, actually a couple of them, that's worth telling over. One of them involves a Virginia woman named Mary Draper Ingalls. She was kidnapped from her home in Draper Meadows, Virginia, on July 8, 1755, by a band of Shawnee Indians. And she was held prisoner by the Shawnee, and she remembers one council that a group of French veterans who had survived this battle of Monongahela, where they met with the Indians. And they were talking animatedly, and she listened to them talking about George Washington. This is just a few weeks after the battle. She had met George Washington back in Virginia, so she listened intently. The Frenchman told her about an Indian chief named Red Hawk, who had been in the victory at Fort Duquesne at the Battle of Monongahela. And Red Hawk told of personally shooting 11 different times at Washington without killing him. At that point, because his gun had never missed its mark before, he ceased firing at him, being convinced that the Great Spirit protected Washington. 15 years later, this same Washington and Dr. Craig, a close friend of his, were traveling north toward the Western Territories, where Washington had real estate investments, to explore some uninhabited regions. While near the junction of the Great Kanawha and the Ohio Rivers, a company of Indians led by an old chief approached them. They had a council fire, and the chief addressed Washington through an interpreter. The chief first explained that after being informed of Washington's approach to that part of the country, he had set out on his long journey just to meet Washington personally and to speak to him about the battle 15 years earlier. Here's what he said. "I am a chief and ruler over my tribes. I've traveled a long and weary path that I might see the young warrior of the great battle. It was on the day when the white man's blood mixed with the streams of our forest that I first beheld this chief. I called to my young men and said, "Mark, yon tall and daring warrior, quick, let your aim be certain, and he dies." Our rifles were leveled, rifles which, but for you, knew not how to miss. 'Twas all in vain, a power mightier far than we shielded you. Seeing you were under the special guardianship of the Great Spirit, we immediately ceased to fire at you. I am old, and soon shall be gathered to the great council fire of my fathers in the land of shades. But ere I go, there is something bids me speak in the voice of prophecy. Listen, the Great Spirit protects that man. Certainly did. It also protect the nation that he helped to found. God's hand on America. In 1770, long before he took over command of the Continental Army, George Washington, on a trip to the wilderness with a friend of his named Dr. Craik, encountered an aged Indian chief who told him, "The Great Spirit protects that man," gesturing toward Washington, "and guides his destinies. He will become the chief of nations, and a people yet unborn will hail him as the founder of a mighty empire. I am come to pay homage to the man who is the particular favorite of heaven and who can never die in battle." It was understood at the time. And in fact, Washington himself showed that kind of reckless courage on the battlefield. But he wasn't the only American general and president who seemed indestructible. Andrew Jackson, the 7th president of the United States, was also a veteran of countless battles. Unlike Washington, however, he wasn't immune from being wounded. In fact, he was frequently wounded. He was wounded as a child by a saber of a British officer during the American Revolution. And then he carried with him throughout his life two bullets that couldn't be removed from his body that he got not in battle against Indians or the British, but that he got in the battle of duels with various other political figures on the Tennessee frontier. One of them, later a very famous as a leading senator from Missouri in the United States Senate, Thomas Hart Benton. Andrew Jackson also suffered from malaria. He suffered from dysentery. He was a very tall man, about 6'1", 145 pounds, gaunt, emaciated, and by the time he became president, somewhat frail. And yet he became the first president to face assassins' bullets while he was in the White House. Here's how it occurred. On January 30th, 1835, President Jackson, in the middle of his second term as President of the United States, he had replaced and defeated John Quincy Adams, visited the House of Representatives to attend funeral services for a member of the House and a political ally known as Warren R. Davis, member of the House from South Carolina. The chaplain, speaking at the time, emphasized the fact that life was uncertain, particularly for the aged. Jackson was 67. Harriet Martineau, a famous British visitor, she's famous because her observations of America and of Washington are so trenchant, wrote, "There sat the gray-haired president, looking scarcely able to go through this ceremonial." Once the sermon was finished, President Jackson filed past the casket, and with the cabinet, he went down the steps into the rotunda of the Capitol building. At that moment, a stranger approached him, a stranger who everybody said was good-looking, despite the fact that his face was covered by a thick black beard. A stranger approached him and came to within 6 feet of the President of the United States. At first, no one noticed him draw a small, gleaming pistol, which he aimed directly at Jackson. As he pressed the trigger, the report rang out through the stone chamber like a rifle shot, according to eyewitnesses or ear witnesses, I guess you'd say, in this situation. Jackson wasn't wounded. So the fellow took another pistol out of his belt, a second pistol, also loaded with a single ball. Jackson was one of the first to realize what was happening. Crack went the second weapon, also fired. Jackson wasn't wounded. At that point, the president lunged at his assailant, trying to beat him with his cane, and shouted to his associates, "Let me go, gentlemen! I'm not afraid. They can't kill me. I can protect myself." What had happened was so extraordinary that I personally am amazed that this has gotten no more attention than it has from historians or from history buffs. It's the first attempt at an assassination ever of an American president. From 6 feet away, point blank range, this fellow, Richard Lawrence, who was an unemployed house painter in Washington and a nut, he thought he was the heir to the King of England. He called himself King Dick and was so crazy that even at the time they couldn't execute him. He was condemned to insane asylums for the rest of his life, which led some of President Jackson's political allies to decry the whole insanity defense. In any event, Richard Lawrence fires at him, and what they did is they took the pistols to the Navy Department to have them tested. And at the Navy Department, they examined the pistols and showed that their percussion caps had detonated. That's why you heard the shots. But for some reason, neither charge in neither pistol had been ignited. When they took it to the Navy Department, they tried to put other bullets in to see if these pistols worked. They worked perfectly, lethally. No problem firing. One expert at the time on small arms calculated that the chance of two successive misfires was less than one in 125,000. Meanwhile, President Jackson went back to the White House and went about his business with a meeting with Major General Winfield Scott as if nothing had happened. Somehow, he was not meant to be killed in that assassination attempt. Had he been, Martin Van Buren would have become president. The whole development of the Whig Party would have been different. The whole course of American history would have been very different. Jackson, in the middle of his second term, survives an assassination attempt. But perhaps you can look beyond matters of life and death. And shots fired without impact, even in the Capitol building. And look at the origins of what has become America's most populous state for yet another indication of some of the peculiar planning that the Almighty seems to have laid out for these United States of America. You've all heard of the 49ers and the gold rush in California. The timing of that gold rush presents one of the truly amazing coincidences, if it is a coincidence, in American history, God's hand on America. Days in the history of the great state of California was the discovery of gold at Sutter's Mill. I mean, truly a fateful day. It provoked one of the fastest migrations of human beings ever seen up to that time. Within a year, 80,000 people had made their way to the California gold fields to try to get rich quick. Basically, it was the gold rush that built up the state of California. James Marshall, an employee of Colonel John Sutter, the Swiss immigrant who had built up his little personal empire, was up trying to build a mill on Sutter's Creek, and he noticed some gold flecks, brought them back, got them assayed, and that all occurred on January 24th, 1848. It was a couple of weeks before the word spread, but as soon as the word spread of the discovery of gold in California, in the little village of San Francisco, people deserted their shops. They ran right up to the mountains, to the gold fields, to try to get rich quick. People actually made their way through Panama. There was no canal at the time, fighting through the jungles. Or they rode on ships all across the ocean down the bottom of South America. Or they made their way overland to try to get to California. All of that began January 24th, 1848. What's spooky, weird, peculiar about that? California, when all of this was happening, had just become American territory. January 24th, gold is discovered. It's not heard about in the rest of the country for a couple of weeks, but February 2nd, just some 8 days, 9 days later of that same year, is when the Mexicans finally signed the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, in which they gave California to America at the end of the Mexican War, in return for $15 million. It was a bargain. Actually, America had been prepared, President Polk had been prepared to pay a lot more, close to $30 million. But think about it. $15 million, Mexico ceded California, New Mexico, Arizona, Nevada, Utah, and parts of Colorado and Wyoming. Would the same deal have been made at the end of long and complicated negotiations with the Mexicans if the Mexicans had known that the same week that they were signing this treaty, gold had been discovered in Sutter's Mill? An interesting question. I'll tell you what's a most compelling question to me. Why don't people today who live in this great country see the hand of Providence as clearly as people in the past did? The greatest historian of the 19th century, the greatest American historian, George Bancroft, who wrote A History of the United States in 1876, said in the introduction to that history, quote, "It is the object of the present work to explain the steps by which a favoring Providence, calling our institutions into being, has conducted the country to its present happiness and glory." We need to appreciate that same Providence. And if you want a copy, permanent copy of this show, History Tapes on the American Revolution and other topics, call 1-800-468-0464, Tree Farm Communications, for the true story and a truer appreciation of the greatest nation on God's green earth. And another great day in the greatest nation on God's green earth. You can call it fate, you can call it nature, you can call it destiny, you can call it providence, or you can call it God. Whatever you want to call it, there has been a higher power shaping the United States of America. And on this very special holiday broadcast, we look at some of the amazing twists and turns that that higher power has taken in God's hand on America. Now, a lot of people have a mistaken idea that whenever you talk about a divine involvement in historical affairs, you're talking about a God who comes down to protect, to reward, to cherish and nourish this great country. That's been true in many instances in our history. But any father, if you believe that God is a father, who just rewards, who just protects, isn't a real father. A father also can provide punishment. A father can also provide chastisement. And certainly no punishment has been more devastating, more bloody, more horrendous in the history of this country than the war between the states, or as it is less accurately known, the Civil War. Punishment for what? Well, certainly for people living in the northern states, they understood the entire conflict as a punishment for the great sin of slavery. Now, you might say that every nation on earth had been a slave-holding nation at one time or another, and almost all nations were through the beginning of the 19th century. So why should America be punished uniquely? Because other nations on earth didn't have founding documents that promised that all men are created equal and endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. There's no question that America fell short of those ideals in sustaining and allowing slavery for the first years of this republic. One of the people who absolutely understood that there was guilt involved with the institution of slavery was an individual who you wouldn't think would cast such a long shadow. You wouldn't think it because he was a fanatic. He was a lunatic. He was clearly insane, but he was also a God-haunted man who became a most unlikely hero of the Civil War era. His name was John Brown. He had succeeded at absolutely nothing in his life. Failed at land speculation, had legal problems of enormous consequence, was accused of writing bad checks, embezzlement. When he lived in Ohio, he had 21 pending lawsuits in Ohio alone. He was a kind of guy you really did not want to meet. He had 20 children. He viewed himself as an Old Testament prophet. To give you some indication of the attitude that he had and the anger that seized within him, his favorite biblical verse, he used to say, was from the book of Job, the verse which declared, "And I break the jaws of the wicked and plucked the spoil out of his teeth." John Brown did more than plucking out of teeth. In 1857, during the border wars in Kansas, he and four of his sons, late one night, showed their opposition to slavery by going to a district that was known to be the home of some slave-supporting settlers, slavery-supporting settlers, and he took out five men and boys, and Brown and his sons, in the moonlight, hacked them to death at Pottawatomie Creek, hacked them to death with broadswords. All of this was based on a transforming experience he had had in 1837. He attended the funeral of an abolitionist named Elijah P. Lovejoy, who was murdered by a mob. He was lynched by a mob. Someone who had been a courageous voice against slavery. At the funeral for that abolitionist, Brown came in. He was unknown to most of the people in the room. But in a loud voice, he called out from the back of the service, raising his right hand as if taking an oath, and saying, "Here before God in the presence of these witnesses, I consecrate my life to the destruction of slavery." He had 20 children. He beat savagely his own children. They were involved in his various projects. One of the projects after the massacre at Pottawatomie Creek involved taking some fugitive slaves up to Canada. He went up to Canada, and while he was there, he planned this lame-brained scheme to lead a little army down to Virginia to start a slave rebellion. His idea was that he would declare himself as an avenging prophet, and slaves from all of the nearby plantations would rally to his cause, would take up the arms that he had seized, that he had brought with him, and join his little army of 18, an army that included 5 free blacks and 13 white men, including his own sons. They came down to Harper's Ferry, Virginia. Today it's part of West Virginia. Then it was all part of the same state of Virginia. And they seized an armory there. They brought with them this strange little army, a wagon that was filled with 200 rifles, 200 pistols, and 1,000 pikes, stakes with the sharpened edges. He was going to arm thousands of slaves, thousands of avenging blacks with these implements, and then march across the Appalachian Mountains, wreaking havoc and freeing slaves everywhere. It was a wild scheme. It never worked, not for a moment. Brown marched in with his army. Ironically, the first person they killed, in the town of Harper's Ferry was a free black man, a watchman, who they shot dead as they were seizing the armory. They took hostage a great-great-grandnephew of George Washington and asked him to present his relative sword because John Brown had delusions of grandeur. But instead of the slaves rising up to support them, the local people in the village rose up to oppose them and to surround them and trap them in the armory. The first one of John Brown's followers to die was a freed slave named Dangerfield Newby. He was killed. After his body was taken out, someone in the crowd cut off his ears as a trophy. The entire project clearly had no chance of victory, despite the fact that a number of very prominent people in New England, intellectuals and abolitionists, had provided John Brown money to buy these weapons that he brought down with him. No one came to join his little band of 18. And eventually, a group of 90 United States Marines arrived from Washington. And of course, the Marines had no problem storming the armory at all. They were commanded by one of the most brilliant officers in the United States Army, a distinguished veteran of the war against Mexico named Robert E. Lee. They captured John Brown. He was wounded and battered by the time they took him prisoner. And then, of course, he was put on trial. Because deaths had occurred during his disastrous and ill-considered raid on Harper's Ferry, he was facing hanging. And during his trial period, a number of people said, "Mr. Brown, you should plead insanity." He was clearly insane, but he refused to do that. He understood that he meant more to the cause that he was trying to advance, if he were dead than if he were alive. During his trial, he refused to plead insanity, and in fact relished the ability to speak to the court. And during that speech, he pointed to a Bible, declared that this Bible teaches me that all things whatsoever that men should do to me, I should do even so to them. I believe that to have interfered as I have done, as I have always freely admitted that I have done, in behalf of God's despised poor, I did no wrong but right. He had one more point to make. Looking at the courtroom, he said, "Now, if it is deemed necessary that I should forfeit my life for the furtherance of the ends of justice, and mingle my blood further with the blood of my children, and with the blood of the millions in this slave country, whose rights are disregarded by wicked, cruel, and unjust enactments, I say, let it be done." John Brown had failed at everything he had done, including the raid at Harper's Ferry. But he succeeded at dying. In fact, in his death, he began to live up to the role that he had chosen for himself, of prophet. Why did people sing John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave? We'll tell you, God's hand on America. Faced the gallows just 7 weeks after his disastrous raid on Harper's Ferry, Virginia, a raid on a federal armory where he wanted to secure weapons to use in a slave rebellion that never materialized. Some 7 weeks later, he's facing death. And a number of people came to him and secretly met with him in his cell and offered a last-minute plan for a jailhouse rescue. Brown said no. "I am worth now infinitely more to die than to live," he said. He was absolutely right. He wrote to his wife, in fact, "I have been whipped, but I am sure I can recover all the lost capital occasioned by that disaster by only hanging a few moments by the neck, and I feel quite determined to make the utmost possible out of a defeat." The reaction of people in the North to John Brown, this maniac with the wild eyes and the Old Testament beard, and the bloody hands, was truly extraordinary. Henry David Thoreau, the New England writer, Massachusetts writer, saw that Brown's imminent hanging was similar, he thought, to the crucifixion of Christ. He viewed those two events as, quote, two ends of a chain which is not without its links. He is not old Brown any longer. He is an angel of light. The date of the execution was set for December 2nd. Brown met with people in his cell. He had become famous. He was an absolute obsession in the press, and the Southern press as a demon, and the Northern press as more and more a hero. Leading writer and religious thinker Theodore Parker weighed in by declaring, "There have been few spirits more pure and devoted than John Brown's, and none that gave up their breath in a nobler cause. Let the American state hang his body, and the American church damn his soul. The road to heaven is as short from the gallows as from a throne." Ralph Waldo Emerson said of Brown that he was a saint whose fate yet hangs in suspense, but whose martyrdom, if it shall be perfected, will make the gallows as glorious as the cross. Brown understood all this, and he accepted his doom with great dignity. The day of his execution, the day of his hanging, a wagon came up in front of the jailhouse with a large pine box on it that contained a heavy oak casket. The jailer invited Brown to get up and to sit on the casket, and he did. He was wearing bedroom slippers and a badly fitting dark suit. And Brown handed the jailer a scrap of paper on which he wrote what he hoped would be recorded as his last words. And then, in front of a crowd of people, including some 1,500 soldiers, Brown went to his death without saying another word. Among those who viewed his execution was an actor, a popular, very handsome actor who was part of a militia regiment called the Richmond Grays. His name was John Wilkes Booth. He later became famous or infamous in his own right. He said Brown was a brave old man, a man inspired, the greatest character of this century. That even though John Wilkes Booth was a strong supporter of slavery. Another witness to Brown's execution was a professor of physics, natural science, at Virginia Military Institute, a blue-eyed, mysterious, intense gentleman who never was particularly popular with his students. His name was Thomas Jonathan Jackson, later known as Stonewall Jackson. He watched the execution as well. And after Brown's death, they read the last words that he had scribbled on his note. The words declared, "I, John Brown, am now quite certain that the crimes of this guilty land will never be purged away but with blood." Within a year and a half, there were tens of thousands of volunteers who marched off to war for the Union, singing, "John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave. John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave. His soul goes marching on." His soul? This strange, warped, bloody man, this failure at everything that he tried, writer of bad checks and embezzler. By his example, he helped to divide the Union, precisely because people of the South were so horrified at the hero worship attending the late John Brown. The war came, and with the war, astonishing levels of bloodshed. So much so that the bloodiest day, single day of fighting, during the war between the states occurred in Maryland in 1862 at the Battle of Antietam. And it was so bloody, in fact, that more people died by a long shot in that particular encounter than all the Americans who lost their lives in the War of 1812, the Mexican War, and the Spanish-American War combined. In fact, the casualties at the Battle of Antietam numbered four times the total suffered by American soldiers at the Normandy beaches in 1944. And if you want to see the work of Providence in a particularly amazing and illogical way, then look at this Battle of Antietam. Because in many ways, that battle marked the turning point of the war. Everyone talks about the Battle of Gettysburg. But by the time Gettysburg happened, the South was already losing the war in the West. It was a different time. It was a different time a year later. If the South had won the Battle of Antietam, what the Southerners called the Battle of Sharpsburg, everything would have been different. Because at that moment, Robert E. Lee had launched a promising invasion of Maryland in the North. He was headed for Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And a witness to his army of Northern Virginia, some 50,000 strong, wrote, "They were the dirtiest men I ever saw, a most ragged, lean, and hungry set of wolves. Yet there was a dash about them that the Northern men lacked. They rode like circus riders. Many of them were from the far South and spoke a dialect I could scarcely understand. They were profane beyond belief and talked incessantly. It was precisely their individuality, their circus rider gyrations," historian Shelby Foote says, "that was part of what made them so terrible in battle, leading up to this most terrible battle that was decided because of three lost cigars. God's hand on America."
God's Hand on America continues on disc number two in this set. This completes the recording on disc one.
September of 1862, the Confederate States of America reach their absolute zenith. They've beaten the Yankees in several battles in a row, and now suddenly Robert E. Lee takes his ragged, hungry army, victorious army, and heads north. Their morale is soaring because now they're not just defending Richmond. They're taking the battle into Yankee soil. First, they're going to liberate Maryland. At least that was the idea. Maryland was a slaveholding state, and there was a lot of Southern sentiment, pro-Southern sentiment, but Lee was disappointed at the response in Maryland. But his goal was to push forward over the mountains and to reach Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, state capital of Pennsylvania, and a major rail center. He would cut rail connection between the western states of the Union and the eastern states of the Union. And then, if he conquered Harrisburg, he felt that he would have a free hand to turn to the east and descend from the north on Baltimore, on Washington, or on Philadelphia and end the war. It was a good plan. It was a gamble. But if Lee continued to be successful and carried the war to the north, there was a real chance that Great Britain, perhaps even France, would recognize the Confederate States, and their independence would be assured. On the way up north, he worried about one thing. In Harper's Ferry, Virginia, yes, the same Harper's Ferry that John Brown had unsuccessfully attacked, there was a federal garrison in his rear. And he had the idea that he would divide his army on the way north, his 50,000 men, sending a separate army, series of armies actually, into Harper's Ferry to conquer the garrison there before he headed north. A number of his associates said, "General Lee, you can't divide your army again in front of a superior opponent. General McClellan, will be coming after you. And Lee said this, "Are you acquainted with General McClellan? He is an able general, but a very cautious one. His army is in a very demoralized and chaotic condition and will not be prepared for offensive operations, or he will not think it so, for 3 or 4 weeks. Morris Robert, General Lee, absolutely understood his opponent. McClellan, as Lincoln famously declared, had a case of the slows. He always overestimated his opponent. He never moved decisively. And Lee's gamble would surely have worked, except for one of the most remarkable twists in the history of warfare. What happened was that McClellan was moving his Army of the Potomac gradually, cautiously, in the direction of meeting Lee. And they went through Frederick, Maryland, marching through with the 27th Indiana. They camped at a field near Frederick, Maryland, and it was a Saturday morning. They were chasing the Confederates, who were to their north, and at that recent Confederate campsite near Frederick, the men were out Saturday morning, taking a break, playing harmonica, trying to smoke cigars to make some coffee in camp, when two members of the 27th Indiana, Private B.W. Mitchell and Sergeant J.M. Bloss, found an envelope lying in the grass. They opened it up and were delighted to find 3 cigars. And they were about to smoke the cigars when they noticed that the wrapping for the cigars was some official-looking paper. While Bloss was hunting for a match, Private Mitchell looked at the document. It said on the paper, "Headquarters, Army of Northern Virginia, Special Orders 191. At the bottom was written, "By command of General R. E. Lee, R. H. Chilton, Assistant Adjutant General." They thought this was interesting, and they took it to the company commander, who then took them to regimental headquarters, where the colonel examined the handwritten sheet along with the 3 cigars, as if those cigars might have some significance, too. The guys never did get to smoke the cigars. And then they started showing it up the line, showing it up the line. McClellan's first reaction was, "This is a fraud, these captured orders. How could it be something like this?" It showed exactly where Lee had divided his army, where his army was. It showed McClellan his opportunity. But then there was a staff officer who saw the signature, R.H. Chilton, Lee's adjutant. He had known Chilton before the war, identified the handwriting, and all of a sudden, George B. McClellan, slow, cautious, some would say even cowardly, said, "Here is a paper with which, if I cannot whip Bobby Lee, I will be willing to go home. Lost cigars and lost orders change the course of human history. God's hand on America." In September of 1862, if Robert E. Lee had succeeded in his Maryland campaign, had conquered Harrisburg, the entire course of the war between the states would have been different, dramatically different. But because somebody, we don't know who it was, left 3 cigars wrapped in some general orders in a field in Frederick, Maryland, even George B. McClellan had no excuse for hesitating. He knew, because of what he read in those orders, that Lee had divided his army, and that McClellan was closer to any of the shattered pieces of those army, those divided pieces, than those pieces were to one another. And so he moved, well, not decisively exactly, McClellan was incapable of that, but he moved toward a confrontation in the single bloodiest day of fighting in the history of American arms. The Battle of Antietam, called in the South the Battle of Sharpsburg. Nearly 6,000 men died. There were another 17,000 grievously wounded. More people died and were wounded at Gettysburg, but that was over the course of a three-day battle. This was a one-day battle. It was inconclusive, but Lee's invasion had to turn back afterward. George B. McClellan wrote to his wife after the battle, "Those in whose judgment I rely tell me that I fought the battle splendidly and that it was a masterpiece of art. I feel that I have done all that can be asked in twice saving the country. I feel some little pride in having, with a beaten and demoralized army, defeated Lee so utterly. Well, one of these days, history will, I trust, do me justice." Wrong. What history recognized is that if it weren't for the accidental discovery of some lost orders, he would have had no success at all in stopping Lee. But this wasn't the end of strange, unlikely occurrences and twists that helped to determine the fate of the Union. Another strange twist involved probably the single greatest commander on either side in the entire war between the states. That would be Thomas Jonathan Jackson, known as Stonewall Jackson, the one-time physics professor at Virginia Military Institute, whose intense, flaring blue gaze gave him the nickname to many of his troops of Old Blue Light. He was a devout Presbyterian. He recited Psalms every day. He actually had great concern for freed slaves, helped to start a Sunday school for black children back in Lexington, Virginia. Jackson won with Lee his greatest victory a few months after Antietam, won that victory at Chancellorsville. But at night, thinking of a nighttime continued attack to try to absolutely destroy the Federal Army, he was riding with a few of his officers on board his horse between lines, highly dangerous. Some Union sentries shot at him. The horses panicked. Eventually, Confederate sentries shot at him. He was wounded by his own men. Two of the officers riding with him died. And Stonewall Jackson, at the moment of great triumph, just before the conclusion of the Battle of Chancellorsville, had to be carried away on a stretcher. The doctors looked at him. They amputated his left arm, but they were virtually sure that he would recover. Robert E. Lee said of the injury to his number one lieutenant, "Jackson has lost his left arm, but I have lost my right." They took Jackson to a little farmhouse at a place called Guinea Station. And there he lay, recovering from his amputation, while the entire Confederacy prayed for his welfare. His wife, he was a relative newlywed just before the war, arrived to soothe him. He was suffering from pneumonia and the after effects of the amputation, and suddenly the physicians began to worry because he developed a fever. He said to his wife not to wear a long face. "I love cheerfulness and brightness in a sick room." Lee said Jackson could not possibly die. "God will not take him from us now that we need him so much." Jackson himself agreed. But of course, he said, he would abide whatever God decided. "I do not believe I shall die at this time," he said. "I am persuaded the Almighty has yet a work for me to perform." On the morning of Sunday, May 10th, the surgeon told Mrs. Jackson that the general would not last the day. And she gently came to her husband and told him that he was not long for this world. "Dr. Jackson," said, "Anna informs me that you have told her that I am to die today. Is it so?" The doctor nodded that it was. "Very good, very good," Jackson said. "It is all right. It is the Lord's day. My wish is fulfilled. I have always desired to die on Sunday." That afternoon, he dozed on and off. His breathing was labored. At 3 o'clock, he was imagining that he was living through another battle. Living through a battle, and he ordered A.P. Hill to the attack. He said, "Order A.P. Hill to prepare for action. Pass the infantry to the front. Tell Major Hawks We never know what he wanted to tell Major Hawks. He smiled and closed his eyes, and then uttered his last words. "Let us cross over the river," he said, "and rest under the shade of the trees." At that point, he died. Jefferson Davis, president of the Confederacy, declared a day of national mourning. According to an article in the Central Georgian, "From the Rio Grande to the Potomac will go up one wild wail of lamentation over the great departed." The loss was incalculable to the Confederacy. Just a few weeks later, the Battle of Gettysburg occurred. Had Jackson been available to fight in the battle, particularly on the decisive third day, to lead his normal corps with his normal success, the course of that battle would have been different. Had he not been fired upon by his own sentry, had he not, foolhardy and daring, ridden out between enemy lines, he would have been there for a different destiny at the Battle of Gettysburg and in the war itself. But the greatest loss of all in the war occurred on another religious day, not the Lord's Day Sunday, but Friday, Good Friday, God's hand on America. Abraham Lincoln, 16th President of the United States, was a man of dreams and visions. He discussed his dreams, especially when they troubled him. And in the first week of April, 1865, as General Lee was just on the verge of surrendering to General Grant at Appomattox, he was deeply troubled by a dream that he felt the need to describe. In the dream, he awoke in the middle of the night and walked through the silent White House, following the sounds of sobbing. When he came to the East Room, he saw a casket draped in black. He asked, "Who's dead?" And one military guard replied, "It is the president." A week later, Good Friday, April 14, 1865, he had another dream that he felt the need to discuss at a cabinet meeting. General Grant was with him at the cabinet meeting when Lincoln shocked those present by describing this recurring vision, in which in sleep he was on the water and he seemed to be in some singular, indescribable vessel, and he was moving with great rapidity towards an indefinite shore, unquote. Lincoln chose to see that as a promising dream. Thought it meant that good news would be coming. Actually, that same night, Good Friday, April 14th, 1865, he was shot in Ford's Theater, shot in the head by John Wilkes Booth, that same actor who had joined with Stonewall Jackson in witnessing the John Brown execution. And what did it all mean? This war in which some 600,000 Americans had given their lives, bloodiest war in our history. Lincoln described the meaning in his second inaugural address some 5 weeks before he died. He said this, "If we shall suppose that American slavery is one of those offenses which, in the providence of God, must needs come, but which, having continued through his appointed time, he now wills to remove, and that he gives to both North and South this terrible war as the woe due to those by whom the offense came, shall we discern therein any departure from those divine attributes which the believers in a living God always ascribe to him? Fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray," Lincoln said, "that this mighty scourge of war may speedily pass away. Yet if God wills that it continue until all the wealth piled by the bondman's hand, 250 years of unrequited toil, shall be sunk, and until every drop of blood drawn with a lash shall be paid by another drawn with a sword, as was said 3,000 years ago, so still it must be said, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether." Abraham Lincoln looked for God's hand in history. He looked for it and he found it. We should do no less. Searching for God's hand on America.
This presentation will continue on tape number 2. This completes the recording on tape 1.
And another great day in the greatest nation on God's green earth. Yes, it is God's green earth. It is also God's nation. For people who care to look, there is a discernible involvement of the Almighty in the affairs of the United States of America, shaping this country, punishing this country, determining a series of unlikely and indeed astonishing incidents that we celebrate in this special holiday edition of the Michael Medved Show, God's Hand on America. And to discern God's hand, to take a look at what is going on with the destiny of this country in some of these very strange and intriguing incidents, pregnant with meaning, you do no better than to look at some of the larger-than-life figures who have played such a conspicuous role in the history of this country. And when you talk about American characters who are larger than life, none of them more fascinating than Theodore Roosevelt. His brushes with death, three of them, operated in such a contradictory and surprising way and shaped the history of the whole country in such an unexpected manner that they deserve very conspicuous attention. First of all came what he called his crowded hour, his great moment as a leader of men in battle at San Juan Hill, where he led his regiment in the Spanish-American War, the Rough Riders, the first volunteer cavalry, composed equal parts of hard riders and cowboys from the Wild West that still existed at the time, and some Ivy League athletes with backgrounds similar to Roosevelt's own privileged background. He preferred Roosevelt as the pronunciation. These men assembled in a cavalry regiment of crack riders found themselves in Cuba in the midst of the Spanish-American War without their horses. Now, it's tough if you're a cavalry regiment without horses. Roosevelt had a horse. One of his horses had drowned because he was a senior officer in the regiment. But it doesn't do you much good when everybody you're working with has to work on foot. They marched through Cuba towards Santiago, a key and strategic area that they were supposed to capture. And Roosevelt wrote, "It was a very lovely morning, the sky of cloudless blue, while the level shimmering rays from the just-risen sun brought into fine relief the splendid palms which here and there towered above the lower growth. The lofty and beautiful mountains hemmed in the Santiago Plain, making it an amphitheater for the battle." And indeed, he saw that amphitheater as a stage in which it was up to him to perform. What's amazing about it is the man had no military experience. He had been a failed candidate for mayor of New York City, president of the New York City Board of Police Commissioners, a member of the state legislature. He had been a cowboy out west following the death of his wife and of his mother. He had gone out west for solace. He was also assistant secretary of the Navy at the beginning of the war, resigned to help lead this regiment. And now it looked as if he would have a chance to distinguish himself under fire, because suddenly his horseless cavalrymen were being pinned down by some withering Spanish fire. The Spaniards, on top of a couple of hills, were shooting down at them with German Mausers, much better rifles than the old Springfields that the Americans were supposed to be using. Roosevelt wrote, "The Mauser bullets drove in sheets through the trees and the tall jungle grass, making a peculiar whirring or rustling sound. Some of the bullets seemed to pop in the air so that we thought they were explosive." One of his best friends, a trooper named Bucky O'Neill, had just finished boasting that the Spanish bullet hadn't yet been manufactured that could kill him. When he was struck and died, Roosevelt observed that it was ironic that it wasn't a Spanish bullet, it was a German bullet. Another trooper, whom Roosevelt had summoned to carry a message, was shot dead while saluting to go on his way. He slumped forward right into Roosevelt's arms, spurting blood. At this point, rather than just taking the fire, Roosevelt mounted his horse and began riding up and down the line of his men, urging them to go up the hill, to go ahead. Some of them responded immediately. Others required convincing. To one member of his regiment, who was slow to rise and join the assault, Theodore Roosevelt shouted indignantly, "Are you afraid to stand up when I am on horseback?" Stung, the man just had time to get to his feet before a bullet hit him and pierced his body from front to back, and he fell down dead. Nevertheless, Roosevelt led his men forward, pushing through other units, forcing regulars to come forward. At one point, a captain of regulars said he hadn't been ordered to seize any hill, and he wanted to stop the Rough Riders, the volunteers. At this point, according to an eyewitness, Richard Harding Davis, war correspondent, Roosevelt said, "If you don't wish to go forward, let my men pass, please." Typical of the man that he remembered to say please even in these situations. He rode up the top of the hill ahead of his men, the only man on horseback, a prime target for the Spaniards. Their bullets never touched him. Near the top of the hill, there was a wire fence. He dismounted because his horse couldn't get past it, and now he was leading the charge on foot. They got up to one hill, but Roosevelt wasn't through. He ran forward toward a second hill, and suddenly he was 100 yards away from all his men before he realized that in the noise of battle, they hadn't heard his order to follow him. He was all by himself. He then ran back, told of his embarrassment, this time got the men to follow. The assault worked. They ran the Spaniards off Kettle Hill and San Juan Hill and on to San Diego, and it became a famous U.S. victory. According to Richard Harding Davis, who was there on the scene of battle, Lieutenant Colonel Roosevelt was the most conspicuous figure in the charge. He described him this way: "Roosevelt mounted high on horseback and charging the rifle pits at a gallop and quite alone, made you feel that you'd like to cheer. He wore on his sombrero a blue polka dot handkerchief, which as he advanced floated out straight behind his head like a guidon. Afterward, the men of his regiment who followed this flag adopted a polka dot handkerchief as the badge of the Rough Riders." It certainly became a badge of honor for Roosevelt. He was proud of what he had achieved. He felt he deserved the Medal of Honor. He actually won the Medal of Honor after some political delay, some 80 years after he died. But he also won great political prominence. And from being an obscure undersecretary of the Navy, assistant secretary of the Navy, he went on, right after the war, months after the war, to be elected governor of New York, disagreed with the bosses in New York State, who then kicked him upstairs and got him nominated to the very harmless post of vice president of the United States. It was harmless, that is, until 6 months after he was inaugurated as vice president. President McKinley was shot in Buffalo, New York. McKinley was supposed to survive. The wound should not have been fatal. It was so certain, in fact, that McKinley was going to survive that Roosevelt went off on a camping trip with his family. While there, the news came that McKinley had died. And Roosevelt became the youngest president in the history of the United States, not yet 41 years old. And yet his strange brushes with death were not over. He served his term as president of the United States, left the White House willingly, turned over the presidency to William Howard Taft. Then they got into a famous argument, and Roosevelt tried to come back in the election of 1912 as a Bull Moose Party candidate running as a third party candidate in a doomed campaign. In the midst of that campaign, October 14th, with just 3 weeks to go, his train pulled into Milwaukee, where he was going to make an important speech. And just as he was on his way from the hotel to the auditorium where he would speak, an unfamiliar fellow approached him and shot him. He pulled out a gun, shooting the candidate at close range. It should have killed him. But Roosevelt was saved by his own long-windedness. He had the folded speech manuscript in the breast pocket of his coat, and it was so long that it slowed the bullet, which then was further slowed by hitting his metal eyeglass case. Still, the bullet lodged in his body. Roosevelt, bleeding, wounded, understood the situation at once. "As I did not cough blood," he told his son a few days later, "I was pretty sure the wound was not a fatal one." Staggering painfully on the podium, he insisted on making his speech and proceeded with one of the most melodramatic performances in American political history. Death had spared Theodore Roosevelt again, but it didn't spare him under very strange circumstances. A mere 8 years later, changing, warping, distorting the course of United States history in totally unexpected, almost inexplicable ways. We'll tell you about it, looking at God's hand on America. During his famous Bull Moose campaign of 1912, as the candidate of the Progressive Party, former President Teddy Roosevelt did something that no other third-party candidate in American history ever did. He finished second. He didn't win, but it wasn't for lack of drama. His brush with death, which was astonishingly close in Milwaukee 3 weeks before the election, I think reveals some of the very strange involvement of fate with this particular remarkable individual. He had been wounded. He was staggering when he reached the podium. And he later said that as he spoke, he insisted on delivering this long speech, that as he spoke, he felt as if with each breath, with each word, he were being stabbed. It was perhaps the most dramatic performance ever by an American politician. Here's how he began his speech. "Friends, I shall ask you to be as quiet as possible. I don't know whether you fully understand that I have just been shot, but it takes more than that to kill a bull moose. The bullet is in me now, so that I cannot make a very long speech, but I will try my best." At that point, he unbuttoned his vest and showed the shirt to the audience, which was absolutely soaked with blood. They gasped in horror and admiration. While he was speaking, and he went on and on with his speech, Roosevelt's advisors are gesturing. They're off stage, gesturing to him. "Come on, get off. We got to take you to the hospital." He hadn't been in the hospital yet. A journalist friend, O.K. Davis, could see the former president losing color. And he gently put a hand on the candidate's arm as if, "Okay, enough already, Mr. Roosevelt." Davis then recorded afterward. "He stopped and glared at me ferociously. He said, 'No, sir, I will not stop. You can't stop me, nor anybody else.'" And then turning to the audience, Roosevelt explained, "My friends are a little more nervous than I am. Don't you waste any sympathy on me. I have had an A1 time in life, and I am having it now." Well, that was the last major speech of the campaign, because he had to go to the hospital and the doctors wouldn't let him out for other major appearances. He didn't win the presidency. And yet, some 8 years later, after losing to Woodrow Wilson, watching Woodrow Wilson blunder his way into World War I, Roosevelt always hated Wilson, hated him with a passion. He was suddenly approaching yet another comeback. He was only 60 years old in 1919. He helped the Republicans campaign against Wilson in 1918. They won a smashing victory as Wilson blew the peace with his grandiose dreams of a League of Nations. And it was very obvious that in 1920, after sitting out the election of 1916, after his Bull Moose campaign of 1912, Teddy Roosevelt, former president of the United States, 60 years old, would be the next president of the United States. He became the acknowledged leader of the Republican Party, and everywhere, you can see it in the press, people talked about the new Roosevelt administration that was destined to occur in 1920. Roosevelt did nothing to discourage that kind of discussion. Not since he left the White House some 12 years before had he been so well placed to claim that party's mantle. The voters had spoken out against Wilson, expressed their preference for Roosevelt, but Roosevelt felt more and more like a wounded individual. Why? Because his son Quentin had died in World War I, had died in a dogfight with German planes. And he was never quite the same after that. He told his sister about the election of 1920, in which he would likely be a candidate. "Corinne, I have only one fight left in me, and I think I should reserve all my strength in case I am needed in 1920. His sister Corinne was alarmed at the whole idea that her vital brother, only 60 years old, was mortal. Asked if he were really ill. "No," he replied, "but I am not what I was, and there is only one fight left in me." Now, what was up with Roosevelt? Well, partially he had gone on a voyage into the Amazon, where he'd almost died because he had gotten sick. And some medical men think that there were still parasites in his body after his return. He had never been fully cured. He went to the hospital on the day the armistice was signed in France. He remained there until Christmas Eve. He told his son Kermit, one of his surviving sons, "I'm glad to be 60, for it somehow gives me the right to be titularly as old as I feel." And then he told his sister Corinne, "Well, anyway, no matter what comes, I've kept the promise that I made to myself when I was 21. "What promise, Theodore?" Corinne asked. "You made many promises to yourself, and I'm sure you've kept them all." And then he said, "I promised myself that I would work up to the hilt until I was 60, and I've done it. I've kept my promise, and now, even though I should be an invalid, I should not like to be an invalid, but even if I should be an invalid or if I should die, what difference would it make?" On Christmas Eve, he came home from the hospital. And the first days of the new year, which was 1919, he had all of his old energy back. He wrote an editorial for the Star. And then he touched up proofs for an article he was doing for Metropolitan Magazine. On January 5th, he put in 11 hours of work on his writing. But later that evening, he told his wife, Edith, he felt strange, as though his heart was about to stop. "I know it is not going to happen," he told her, "but it's such a strange feeling." A nurse came, then a doctor came. They checked his vital signs. They said, "He's fine." To ensure that he had a restful night, a nurse gave him some morphine. At midnight, he went to bed. And he delivered his last words to his assistant, James Amos. "James, will you please put out the light?" He drifted off. His breathing seemed fine. But about 4 o'clock in the morning, James Amos was startled by sudden irregularities in the patient's breathing. At 4:15, his heart stopped and he stopped breathing, and he died. The official cause of death, a coronary embolism. What that means is they don't know what happened to Theodore Roosevelt. He was supposed to wake up and be fine. He didn't. He died at night in bed. Had he lived, he almost certainly would have been president of the United States. There would have been no World War II. There would have been no Adolf Hitler. Because Theodore Roosevelt was not anything like an isolationist. He wouldn't have had any truck with the appeasement, with activities like the Washington Naval Conference or disarmament talk. America would have been prepared and would have been strong. And the world would have been different. But could it be that the Almighty needed, for whatever reason, World War II to happen? And for that, Teddy Roosevelt, spared at San Juan Hill, riding in front of men on foot, unwounded, surviving an assassin's bullet, fine, dies suddenly, just at the eve of resuming power. And what about his cousin, who almost died before he assumed power the first time? God's hand is easy to see in American history, but it isn't always easy to understand. Theodore Roosevelt lives twice when he should have died by reason, and then dies when he should have lived, and thereby changes the course not only of U.S. history, but history of the world. And what about his distant cousin, who pronounced his name Roosevelt, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was elected president in 1932 by an absolute landslide and had his own close brush with death? I'm not now talking about the episode of polio that most people know about. He had polio before he ran for president, before he became governor of New York. I'm talking about another assassination attempt. And an absolutely bizarre one. What is particularly strange about this is that most Americans know nothing about it. On February 15th, 1933, after Franklin Delano Roosevelt had beaten Herbert Hoover in a landslide, he was our president-elect, he had gone on a fishing trip on the yacht of Vincent Astor, a very wealthy man, and he came back to Miami and gave a speech from the back of a car. He was sitting on the back seat of that convertible. Remember, he was crippled. He couldn't use his legs regularly, so he didn't move around so easily. He rode through some packed crowds at Bayfront Park in Miami, and he stopped in front of a stage that was full of VIPs, and among them was a mayor of Chicago who was down there to greet President-elect Roosevelt. The mayor of Chicago's name was Anton J. Cermak. About 30 feet from the car, there was a very short man, dark-complected, Italian immigrant, an unemployed bricklayer whose name was Giuseppe Zangara. He was 5'1" tall. He had suffered lifelong from this terrible stomach. We don't know exactly what it was. People assume it was ulcers. He complained and complained of pain. He never had any family that we know of or connection with any other organization except the Bricklayers Union, which he said he was forced to join. Zangara had a .32 revolver, and he fired 5 times from 30 feet away at the president-elect. Every one of his bullets hit somebody. None of them hit President-elect Roosevelt. 2 people were seriously wounded, Mrs. Mabel Gill, who was just a bystander, and Mayor Cermak of Chicago. The crowd and the police jumped on the gunman. Meanwhile, the Secret Service ordered the driver of FDR's car to get out of that park. But the president-elect said, absolutely not. Go back in there and let's pick up the wounded. On the way to the hospital, he cradled Mayor Cermak of Chicago, cradled his head on his shoulder and kept talking to him, saying, Tony, keep quiet. Don't move, Tony. That was the kind of talk the doctors later said kept Mayor Cermak from going into shock immediately. People got their first glimpse of Roosevelt under pressure. They saw him assuring the crowd he was all right, talking Cermak out of his shock, visiting the victims that night, returning to the hospital the next day with flowers, cards, baskets of fruit. He had met his first test under fire and impressed the whole nation. Meanwhile, Giuseppe Zangara never explained why he was trying to shoot President-elect Roosevelt. He just said he wanted to shoot kings and presidents, because, he said, I don't like no peoples. An FBI investigation showed that he wasn't connected to any peoples that anyone knew of. His whole situation changed when Mayor Cermak died on March 6, 2 days after Franklin Delano Roosevelt said famously in his inaugural, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. After Mayor Cermak died, just 14 days after that, Zangara, who had killed him, was executed. It still stands as the swiftest legal execution in the country. To the minister who was trying to offer prayers before he was electrocuted, Zangara said, get to hell out of here, you son of a bitch. His last words as they put the hood on him were, Viva Italia, goodbye to all poor peoples everywhere. And then he said to the sheriff at the controls, push a da button. And Zangara went off to his fate. Franklin D. Roosevelt had survived his first brush with death. He didn't survive his next brush with death. He died in office little bit more than 12 years later. But his decision as to the vice presidency made a fateful difference of extraordinary consequence for the United States and indeed for the entire free world, and showed yet again God's hand on America. Tell you about how we were spared a commie sympathizer president coming right up. God's hand on America. They say that the presidency is a man-killing job, but only one president actually suffered and died through directly the strain of office. That was Franklin Delano Roosevelt, with his death in April of 1945. Of course, he was also the only president to serve more than two terms. He was elected four times and died just a few weeks after the beginning of his fourth term, completing the first three terms. But the timing of his death shows God's hand on America through an extraordinary act of providence involving the vice presidency. Here's the story. President Roosevelt, the first two terms, had a former Speaker of the House and a conservative Texas Democrat named John Nance Garner as his vice president, Cactus Jack. Cactus Jack was older than Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He was famous basically for one thing, for saying the vice presidency isn't worth a bucket of warm spit, though he didn't say spit. He actually used a less polite term. But when Garner retired and Roosevelt decided to run for a third term, actually Garner was interested in getting the nomination in 1940, Roosevelt picked a new candidate for vice president and personally helped to select Henry A. Wallace of Iowa. Perhaps the most left-wing major politician in the country at that time. Now, one of the things about Henry A. Wallace is he had been Secretary of Agriculture. He had a brilliant record in that regard, but he was deeply, profoundly sympathetic to Joseph Stalin and the Soviet Union. With all of the decoded material from the old Soviet Union, no one has made the case that Wallace was a communist agent in the style of Alger Hiss, or the style of other people who were very prominent in the Roosevelt administration, who were indeed communist agents. But he certainly was surrounded by communist sympathizers, particularly during his own ill-fated campaign for the presidency on the Progressive Party ticket in 1948. The point about this is that Roosevelt was terribly, terribly sick. People around him knew it. And the choice of vice president was enormously important. Roosevelt just barely survived into his fourth term. He died in April of 1945 after being inaugurated in January of 1945. What if he had died a few weeks earlier? If he had died a few weeks earlier, a few months earlier, Henry A. Wallace would have been president of the United States. There would have been no Cold War because there would have been no resistance to Stalin. And there would have been no Harry S. Truman. Truman was chosen eventually by the convention to replace Henry Wallace, partially because there were a bunch of Southern Democrats in particular who were scared to death of Henry Wallace, who didn't like his sanctimonious liberal ways. He was close to the First Lady, Eleanor Roosevelt, and they wanted to dump him from the ticket. But at the convention in Chicago, Roosevelt wasn't even at the convention. He was in San Diego trying to relax and to gather strength for the campaign ahead in 1944. Wallace trotted out a letter that Roosevelt had written to the convention chairman. And it said this about Henry A. Wallace: "I like him and I respect him and he is my personal friend. For these reasons, I personally would vote for his renomination if I were a delegate to the convention." Meanwhile, Roosevelt, in typically devious fashion, was conspiring behind the scenes to dump Wallace. And in fact, he called from San Diego to a bunch of Democratic bosses who were meeting in a hotel room with a senator from Missouri named Harry S. Truman. They were meeting at the Blackstone Hotel, and Roosevelt asked, "Have you got that fellow lined up yet?" meaning Harry Truman. The answer was no. Truman still couldn't decide that he would be willing to be vice president. He was supporting another candidate, Jimmy Burns. "Well, tell the senator," the president said, "that if he wants to break up the Democratic Party by staying out, he can. But he knows as well as I what that might mean at this dangerous time in the world." Truman accepted the nomination. After a contentious battle at the convention, he won it. And America was spared Henry Wallace. What would have happened if Roosevelt, who survived the assassination attempt in 1933, had died, say, in 1943 instead of 1945, Wallace would have become president. He probably could have won the presidency on his own in 1944. And the entire resistance to the Soviet Union, which was the proudest achievement of Harry Truman's administration, would have been very, very different. America, through the timing of President Roosevelt's sudden death, caught a tremendous break. A comparable break involving life and death involved another great president of the United States, Ronald Wilson Reagan. And this is a story that almost everybody knows, though we tend to forget what a close thing it was. Just a few weeks after he became president, Ronald Reagan is riding high, having one success after another with the Congress of the United States. And he goes back to the Washington Hilton Hotel to make a speech. And as he is heading toward his car, he raises a hand to wave to the crowd when a force like a battering ram shoved him forward. And he was falling through the open door of the presidential limousine. He hit his head on the door jamb. And he fell right into the car. He was shot in the chest. A bullet, a .22 caliber Devastator bullet that was supposed to explode, lodged itself an inch from his heart. It was a very close thing. Reagan enormously impressed the nation by his joking, by his wit, by his grace under fire. People at the time didn't know just how seriously the president had been wounded, the transfusions that he needed, the other people who had been wounded on the sidewalk, like James Brady, whose skull was shattered by Hinckley's bullets. Reagan survived. And then 43 days later, another fairly miraculous survival that, like Reagan's, helped to seal the fate of the evil empire and to ensure American victory in the Cold War. Yet another demonstration of God's hand on America. Actually, listen to the words of the Battle Hymn of the Republic. "Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord." The words of "America the Beautiful," the words of the "Star Spangled Banner," any of our patriotic songs, particularly if you look at the latter verses that most people don't pay any attention to, they are profoundly religious, reflecting God's involvement with the United States of America, something that our people have always perceived. And if you ask about our victory in the Cold War, which in many ways is the most significant, the most important, the most magnificent victory in any war for this country because it lasted so long, which two individuals on earth did more to defeat the old Soviet Union than any two? And I think that people will tell you that it was President Ronald Reagan and Pope John Paul II. Two older men, both of them shot in the chest within 43 days of one another, in 1981. Both of them surviving, miraculously. What happens if Pope John Paul II dies from an assassin's bullet and Ronald Reagan dies from an assassin's bullet before his presidency is even started? Frankly, it's too horrific to think about. You want to look for some act of providence. You don't have to look any further than that. It is absolutely remarkable. And it goes to the whole point of looking at what happens, at the past and how it's unfolded, and trying to discern the order in it. In a pretty good book of history and faith called the Bible, in the book of Exodus, there's a famous passage in Exodus chapter 33 where Moses asks to see God's glory. And the Lord tells him, "My face shall not be seen, you shall see my back." How do we understand this? We understand it with the comprehension that God's work is visible after it occurs. You can't always see it face on. But looking at God's back as he passes, you can begin to look at patterns. That's part of what we've been trying to do on a special holiday edition of the Michael Medved Show. If you're interested in a permanent tape version of this show, or of any of our other history shows that try to highlight some of the fateful, significant, amazing aspects of American history, call our friends at Tree Farm Communication, who make these broadcasts available on tape form. You can reach them toll-free at 800-468-0464. For tapes about the American Revolution, some about the war between the states, about American political parties, and yes, God's hand on America. May it continue. May we continue to celebrate together and ponder together the meaning of inspiring and astonishing events for the greatest nation on God's green earth, upward and onward.